metaphors for nirvana, because that is, in the broadest sense, that is what the Buddha taught. I mean, that's the path we're on. And it's a tricky thing, because what is that? You know, and I, by the way, I'm not going to try to define it, but metaphors are helpful in terms of pointing us. So I thought I'd share some stuff I've picked up, heard, whatever, and see if that's helpful for all you all. And, you know, one of the conundrums of the spiritual path is how to direct ourselves toward an elusive goal that we won't realize until we're there. It's like almost like a catch-22 a little bit, because we're pointing in a direction, but we don't know what it is, but we sort of have a hint of what it is. And then we're, you know, we're sort of limited by our limited perceptions, our limited conceptualizations, but we have this sort of innate, undefined sense of what's possible. That's on some level why we're all here. And this conundrum, it creates a lot of problems in human life, because often people kind of in different religions kind of lock down on a particular concept of the undefinable, which can be problematic, especially when different groups become so convinced that they're right and the other one's wrong, that they have disagreements or, you know, wars, conflicts, whatever. So that's too bad. That's too bad. In the Buddhist teachings and his realization, the issues made less loaded or difficult, because he refrained from nailing down in concepts what he had attained and what he was helping others attain. He pointed to it a lot, but he didn't ever define it, which is a big difference. And he said, and he basically sort of said, you can't, you got to realize it. But his entire teaching was intended to point people toward this awakening or ultimate freedom. And this conundrum was arguably easier when he was alive 2,600 years ago, because people didn't have to stretch to get past their conceptualizations when, in fact, an awakened being was right in front of them. I mean, right there, like radiating this amazing awakenedness. And the suttas are full of stories about the Buddha, you know, sharing the Dhamma with a group of people, and then all 500 of them were arhats right there, or with individuals. And I mean, their karma may have been ripe, but this had a lot to do with the fact that they were sitting in front of an awakened, fully awakened being. So here in 2021, this is a little more elusive, and we have this innate sense of direction, but we don't quite know where we're going. And, you know, just to be real clear, I'm in the same boat. I'm very much heading toward that, which I do not yet know. So I'm not pretending anything special, but I can share that after decades of practice, and I'm sure some of you have been practicing a long time, have something similar, that sense of the goal becomes a little sharper and a little clearer and a little brighter. And so I want to share a little bit of that with you to help you in your journeys. And the key word here is nibbana in Pali, nibbana, N-I-B-B-A-N-A, or nirvana in Sanskrit. And that's the word that's most often used, that the Buddha used, I think. Yes, he did, to describe this awakened state. And I'm not going to get into the words of the etymology, because I'm not qualified, but a key point is that while at one level this quest for nibbana is a vast thing, not for us to think it easily happens, but on the other hand, it's also not too far away. Like, both things are true. Buddhadasa, many of you are aware of Buddhadasa, he was one of the great Thai Buddhist masters of the 20th century. And he's very emphatic about this. There's a wonderful book, Heartwood of the Bodhi Tree, which I very much recommend. But he's emphatic about encouraging and embracing our hints of awakening, that's a real thing. And we shouldn't, you know, diminish it or think it means nothing. And towards the end of the book is a discussion about I'm going to be doing some quoting here, as I often do. So you're reading a few things. In a discussion about recognizing emptiness or voidness and its relationship to nibbana, Buddhadasa writes, "You must now go and observe yourself until you can grasp that, in fact, you yourself are frequently void." By void, he's meaning you yourself are recognizing emptiness, is what he's saying. "There are many times when you are unconfused and there is a great deal of mindfulness and wisdom. However, people stupidly skip," that's what he said, "people stupidly skip over such moments, overlook the spontaneous nibbana, and are unaware of its presence, even if it's only a very small nibbana, merely a taste. It's exactly the same as true and lasting nibbana." I think that's really, that has really kept me going in a lot of ways, because I think, you know, everyone gets hints, or they wouldn't be here. Everyone gets hints, and those are real and substantial and worth, you know, stringing together into that which keeps us moving forward on the path. So because we can't grasp or define or nail down or dissect this goal with our conceptual minds, the way to do it is through metaphor. And the Buddha did that constantly in the suttas. And people have been continuing to use metaphor for 2,600 years of trying to point towards awakening without falling into the trap of defining it. So it's a way to help us turn in that direction, to have a taste of it. And what I want to do here is share some quotes from the Samyutta Nikaya, the Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses of the Buddha. This wonderful, if you ever get a chance, it's a wonderful, wonderful collection which has groups of suttas around certain subjects or all together. And then another group, like there's a whole big section about the Vedanas, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, that goes on for several hundred pages. And so it's really wonderful. And I've been reading it and pulling some things out, which you can do on a Kindle. So some of these are quotes I've been pulling out as I've been reading it. And different ways he points, that's part of why these ideas, different way he points to nibbana are so powerful. So I'm going to offer you the Buddha's words, and then using Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, as well as a few quotes from some other great teachers, and just absorb them as you will. And I'll also suggest that there's ways we can link these aspects of nibbana to our mindfulness practice, the actual practice we do, because it does open that door. That's why we do it. And there's really a direct, tangible link. I mean, it works. This stuff works, and you can kind of see how it helps. And it uses a lot of metaphors, but there's three that kind of jump out at me, and that to a certain degree, they all kind of overlap a little bit. But I'm going to especially emphasize three that hopefully maybe something will stick, right? So the three are, one is this whole area of cooling or extinguishing. Cooling or extinguishing, that's the first. The second is the whole area of the unconditioned, in particular the unconditioned. And the third is the whole area of the end of clinging or grasping. And so I'll say a little bit about them and then offer some quotes, and then we'll get a chance to discuss. So in terms of the cooling or extinguishing, this is in the context of metaphors of fire, or the ending of fire, or the cooling being opposite of fire, which appear repeatedly throughout the suttas. The most famous is the fire sermon, which some of you are familiar with, which he delivered not long after he was awakened. And the backstory is kind of interesting. It's not long after he was awakened to a group of ascetics who formerly had been matted hair ascetics. They were fire worshippers in Hindu tradition. So he was trying to like speak to them because that's what they were familiar with. And it was on a hill in Gaya, which is about 12 kilometers away from Bodh Gaya, that he delivered this on this hill. So that's kind of cool. But this famous fire sermon, which is appropriate for what's going on in California and the West, he said, among other things, just a few sections here, he said, "The mind is burning, thoughts are burning, mind consciousness is burning, mind contact is burning. The painful, pleasant, or neutral feeling that arises conditioned by mind contact is also burning. Burning with what? Burning with the fires of greed, hate, and delusion. Burning with rebirth, old age, and death. With sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress, I say. So that's, you know, in a sense, the first noble truth. It's the problem with conditioned reality he's laying out there in his very fierce kind of way. So this whole image of burning, the fires, as he said, of attachment, aversion, and suffering are central to the problem of dukkha. And, you know, as many of you know, the second noble truth has to do with the reason for dukkha is attachment. So things happen to end fires. How do fires end? And we've been, you know, paying a lot of attention to fires. Most of us watch the news in recent weeks, and fires can be extinguished, or they can run out of fuel, or they can be cooled. And in fact, all those things are things that the Buddha talked about in terms of those fires. And an interesting sort of an aside, or it helps with this, is the word Nibbana was in ancient India used to refer to rice which was cooled enough to eat. So when rice had been cooked and then it cooled down so you could eat it, that was Nibbana. It was cooled enough, which is really cool. It really relates to this. And Buddhadasa writes, people nowadays will smile at this, but the word commonly used to describe anything which had once been hot but had since cooled down was Nibbana. When boiled rice is Nibbana, it can be comfortably eaten, while it can't be if it's still too hot. Thus, the cook might call to those waiting outside, come and eat, the rice is Nibbana. So that's like a beautiful way to kind of almost tangibly feel, you know, this Nibbana in the context of fire, the fires of conditional reality and life and death and all those things. And in terms of our mindfulness practice, you know, when we bring mindfulness to a heated arising, maybe something inside, you know, a hot emotion, a repeating obsessive thought that won't go away, we feel it in our guts, you know, that burning feeling, all that kind of burning stuff. When we bring mindfulness to it, it cools it. It's not like it, you know, the point isn't to make it stop, but we start to see through the obsessiveness that made it burn. So it's a way in which mindfulness is really cooling. It just helps us see through the fire that keeps us trapped. And it's so useful that way. And that's, you know, that's the taste of Nibbana that Buddhadasa was referring to right then. You feel yourself lost in something, cultivate mindfulness, and you can see through it right there. That's a taste. It really is. That's a taste. It's precious. It's getting there. It's getting there. So these small steps of cooling are worth cultivating moment by moment, because they turn into big cooling over time. So here's a couple quotes from the Buddha referring to fire in this context. Elsewhere in that Samyutta Nikaya, he says, all the world is on fire. All the world is burning. All the world is ablaze. All the world is quaking. That which does not quake or blaze, that to which worldlings do not resort, where there is no place for Mara, that is where my mind delights. So he's talking about his own realization and how he's in the middle of all that fire, he's finding freedom because of his awakeness. And then here's another one about extinguishing. The word extinguishing is here about the fire of attachment. He says, for one being, attraction, I always turn the he's into ones. For one, attraction and repulsion no more exist. Both have been extinguished, brought to an end for those bhikkhus who are arhats. So those who are awakened, the attraction and repulsion has been extinguished, the fire of it. Those who are arhats, whose taints are destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached their own goal, utterly destroyed the fetters of existence, become completely liberated through final knowledge. So on the one hand, wow, that's big. But on the other hand, you can see the steps. So extinguished. Then the second metaphor, the metaphor of the unconditioned, also comes up a lot in the suttas, and it refers to another sort of aspect of nibbana, a way to kind of approach it, you might say. And at the very root of dukkha, or this unsatisfactoriness of our relationship with everything, if we're not awakened, at the very root of the problem is the fact that everything is conditioned. That means everything that arises, that presents itself to us, comes from a prior condition, and that came from a prior condition. So when we become entranced or enchanted with things through desire or aversion, we're, by definition, we become entwined in this conditioning. I mean, it's totally unsatisfactory. You can't, that's why it's impossible to be free if we're entangled by desire, if we're entangled with conditioned existence, because conditioned existence, it's just cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. There's no, you know, sometimes it's fun and sometimes it's not. And there's no satisfactoriness there. And as we can see in the world, there's a lot of difficulties happen with conditioned existence. And one of the ways mindfulness works, because I'm trying to keep bringing that back, because this has to make, like, you know, one of my goals in doing this is that it actually makes a difference for you, right? One of the ways mindfulness works is we become aware of the dependent arising of things. Because when we're mindful of something arising in us, often we see what's behind it, or we see that it's not inherent in us. It arose and it passes. We start to see that things is cause and effect going all the time. And there's this conditioning happening all the time. And mindfulness helps us see that. When we're not mindful, when people are not mindful of what's arising, they're oblivious. And this interdependence runs unseen in the background. And when it's running unseen, they're snared because they can't find the freedom in it. They're identified with it. They're lost in it. So that's why mindfulness, it helps us unbuckle from this whole stream of causality that just is how phenomena work. There's a Pali word, sankharas, which refers to conditioned phenomena or formations that have been put together. This is a Bhikkhu Bodhi definition, but they've been put together, meaning one thing came from another. They're the result of conditions, so they're assembled in a sense. And Bhikkhu Bodhi writes, through the practice of the Buddha's path, the practitioner arrives at the true knowledge of conditioned phenomena, which disables the generation of active sankharas, active putting together, putting an end to the constructing of conditioned reality and opening up the door to the deathless, the unconditioned, which is nibbana, final liberation from impermanence and suffering. So there's a doorway there. And like Buddhadasa said, even a taste is valuable. In an ultimate sense, when through our practice over many lifetimes, we become completely free of all this conditioning, so we're not tugged by anything, that's when we're free. And that's kind of like another on-ramp to nibbana, to not be tugged by conditioning. Still happening, not tugged by. It's the difference between pain and suffering. You know, the Buddha experienced pain, but he didn't experience suffering. That's the difference. And here's a quote by the Buddha, which connects our realization or our awakening of impermanence to our realization of conditionality, and therefore points at nibbana. He says, but bhikkhus, when one has understood the impermanence of form, its changing, fading away, and cessation, and when one sees as it really is with correct wisdom thus, in the past and also now, all form is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, then sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair are abandoned. So he's saying when we see it, they're abandoned. Remember earlier on, he talked about suffering. Now he's saying, here's how we abandon that. He says, with their abandonment, one does not become agitated. Being unagitated, one dwells happily. A bhikkhu who dwells happily is said to be quenched in that respect. So, happily, that's a novel word in the Dharma, isn't it? Yeah. A bhikkhu dwells happily when one is freed, even though the conditioning is still happening. One is freed. And of course, that brings up the whole area of compassion, because one can be freed in the middle of the suffering of others. So it doesn't mean one is like goofily happening without copping to the suffering of others and responding in a compassionate way. But still, in our own sphere of circumstance, we can be happy irrespective of conditions. That's what the journey's about. And then more helpful, right, to others. Burmese master Mahasi Sayadaw, he was one of the great teachers of the 20th century. It's a lot to do with the lineage of practice from the Burmese side that we do. Writes about Nibbana in a related way. He says, Nibbana is not like a splendid palace, city, or country. It is not like a bright light or some kind of clear, calm element. All of these things are not unconditioned ultimate realities, but concepts or conditioned realities. In fact, Nibbana as an unconditioned reality has simply the nature of cessation, called the characteristic of peacefulness. It is a cessation of defilements and the rounds of suffering. So this is in that arena of conditioning that he's speaking. And then lastly, the third metaphor I wanted to bring up, and it's sort of a metaphor, but the whole area of clinging and craving and clinging in particular, letting go of that as a doorway to Nibbana. It's not quite so metaphor, it's a little more specific, but it's talking about, it's pointing us in that direction by talking about the opposite, you know, talking, referencing clinging, and that's how we see where we're going. So in that way, it's sort of metaphorical. And remember that the Buddha named craving as a second noble truth, the cause of dukkha. And so conversely, we can find freedom or Nibbana by seeing through craving or by dropping it. What, you know, the dropping is easier said than done. We have to see through it to have it fall away. That's what practice does. Can't just turn it off if that's what we're feeling, but we can start to see through it. That's what our mindfulness does. And we can see how interlinked this clinging is with conditioned existence. They're both, like I said, all three of these kind of interconnect with each other. Because when we're clinging, we're turning outward to conditioned existence and hoping it will bring us happiness. But as we know, this quest for outer circumstance to bring happiness is essentially futile. Because the nature of conditioned existence is undependable and offers no ultimate satisfaction. And there's a related aspect where we also cling to our sense of self, because the way we cling to our sense of self is part of trying to find a way to have our sense of self and our relationship with stuff work out nicely all the time. That's part of what drives us to adhere to a sense of self. But through our mindfulness, we start to penetrate this clinging and we start to see the complexity of it, but it starts to thin. I mean, it's like Rodney uses the word thinning a lot. I think it's really, really worked, Rodney Smith, because it's really appropriate for this. It starts to thin. It's not like a magic switch, but it loses its claws, its grip. And through mindfulness, we start to penetrate this selfing. So we see that this sense of self, about which we obsess so much, isn't as concrete or real as we had thought. And so maybe we won't obsess so much once we start to see that it's not so solid. And as this clinging thins, then so does our clinging to externals, to conditioned existence. And right there, that's moving us in the direction of nibbana. The Buddha said, when one dwells contemplating danger in things it can be clung to, craving ceases. With the cessation of craving comes cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of existence, cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So that's liberation. That's liberation. And he says, when one sees this as it really is with correct wisdom, the mind becomes dispassionate and is liberated from the taints by non-clinging. By being liberated, it is steady. By being steady, it is content. By being content, one is not agitated. Being unagitated, one personally attains nibbana. One understands, destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. So that's a powerful statement of what this is, but there's no more for this state of being. And here's another, using the word happy again. Happy indeed are the arhats, the awakened beings. No craving can be found in them. Cut off is the conceit I am. Burst asunder is delusion's net. They have reached the unstirred state. Limpid are their minds. They are unsullied in the world, the holy ones, without taints. I think I'll read that one again because we're near the end and it's so cool. Happy indeed are the arhats. No craving can be found in them. Cut off is the conceit I am. Burst asunder is delusion's net. They have reached the unstirred state. Limpid are their minds. They are unsullied in the world, the holy ones, without taints. And then lastly, the Buddha said to this monastic Radha, I can't remember the exact sutta because I pulled it out, but anyway, he said, Radha, the holy life is lived with nibbana as its ground, nibbana as its destination, nibbana as its final goal. So too, Radha, scatter form, demolish it, shatter it, put it out of play, practice for this destruction of craving. Scatter feelings, scatter perception, scatter volitional formations, scatter consciousness, demolish it, shatter it, put it out of play. Practice for the destruction of craving. For the destruction of craving, Radha, is nibbana. And there is that, it just pervades the suttas. I think that's one of the amazing things here in the 21st century, that to just feel how much the Buddha was confident in what all we all could do. So let's just sit for a moment.